Hello and welcome to the Heathrow's results for the 9 months to the 30th of September 2016. Throughout this call, all participants will be in listen-only mode, and afterwards there will be a question and answer session. Also, just to remind you, this session is being recorded. I'll now hand you over to John Holland-Kaye, the CEO. Please begin.
Well, hello. This is John Holland-Kaye, Chief Executive of Heathrow Airport Holdings. Thank you for joining us. I'm here in the boardroom at our Compass Centre overlooking the runways at Heathrow, and I'm joined by Javier Echave, who's our acting CFO, and by Andrew Effiong, our treasurer. I'm just going to update you on the operational highlights for the first 9 months of the year. Javier will run through the financial performance, and then I'll just cover on the strategic agenda and update on expansion in particular, which I know is a point of interest. And then we can take any questions at the end. And if you're viewing remotely, then you can look at the presentation through the link on the invitation or directly on our website. So I'll start with slide three, which just gives a quick overview. And you'll see that we've continued to have a strong performance through 2016, operationally, financially, and strategically. And I was delighted that Heathrow was named once more the best major airport in Europe. And that's rated by passengers in their feedback. Traffic was strong over the summer. We had an exceptionally busy month in July, which was the highest monthly traffic in the last 70 years. Now, as you know, our vision is to give passengers the best airport service in the world. And so we're continually raising standards. And I'm delighted that we've had a good year so far operationally with good service standards, which I'll come on to shortly. But from a financial point of view, we had a healthy combination of prices coming down for aeronautical charges, but revenue growing through a combination of healthy commercial income and growth in passengers, and costs coming down by 3.4%. And that allowed us to grow our EBITDA, our main profit measure, by just over 4%. We've also raised £1.6 billion in debt in 2016, including half a billion pounds since the Brexit vote. And that's a good indication of the appetite that the investment community have for Heathrow, and I'm very grateful for the support that you've shown. Strategically, the benefits of our investment in service, in efficiency, in resilience are starting to show. And of course, we are now awaiting on a government decision on expansion, which they told us will come next week. So moving on to slide four, I'll just give you an overview on the traffic patterns that we have been seeing. And we saw an increase earlier in the year, but as you may remember, there was a softening in the second quarter in a more uncertain environment. We had a very strong July, as I've mentioned, and a pretty good August and September. You may ask what the impact of Brexit is as yet, and it's hard to say in terms of overall traffic growth. We're seeing so far about a 0.9% traffic growth in quarter three, and so we've actually seen an acceleration in growth from the half year up to 0.7% now. But as I say, too early to say whether the impact of Brexit is positive or negative in that. But traffic is, and the mix that we have is clearly critical to supporting our role as the UK's hub airport. You'll see if we look at the individual markets that long haul was up 1.7%, driven by the Middle East, Asia, Pacific routes. And the Middle East reflects extra Etihad and Qatar A380 services, while Emirates and Oman both gained extra slots. Asia Pacific growth has mainly come from China, Indonesia, Vietnam, and Thailand. And we've had extra services to China with Air China to Beijing. And, of course, Garuda Indonesia moved their operations from Gatwick to Heathrow, and they've been doing tremendously well since then. We've also had increased frequencies on Vietnam Airways and Thai Airways. In terms of North America, I think quarter one was pretty robust. There's a lot of competition on these routes, a lot of new capacity coming in. The more mature markets are more affected by some of the geopolitical and macroeconomic issues. So the short haul is down marginally year on year. We've seen more growth in continental European traffic. That's shifting capacity by British Airways, putting on more seats to some of those routes. But as you may be aware, we've seen a reduction in domestic services, more than all of which is down to Virgin Little Red stopping their services in 2015. But I'm delighted that the new Inverness service, which British Airways opened in May, has been phenomenally successful. I was trying to book a flight there myself, and it was very hard to get a seat on that route. And that takes our domestic route up to 8, so I'm delighted that's working out well. As you know, we are the UK's biggest port by value, and this is an area that has continued to grow. Overall, up about just over 2% in cargo volumes during the year, but higher growth over the last few months as the exchange rate impacts have boosted exports from the UK. And we're now forecasting 75.3 million passengers for the full year. A lot of that growth year on year is driven by the leap year. Turning on to slide 5, just to compare how we have been performing against the other major hubs. We remain the biggest hub airport in Europe, and you'll know that our growth has been constrained by some of the capacity issues that we have, which limit the number of movements we have. But if we look more broadly, you'll see that there's some quite interesting changes taking place. We've seen a slowdown and, in some cases, a decline in traffic at Frankfurt and Charles de Gaulle. Istanbul has slowed down significantly. Amsterdam and Madrid are continuing to surge ahead. So, strangely enough, we've gone from being the lowest growing to among the major airports to being the third fastest growing, albeit we're some way behind in terms of growth rates. And a lot of this reflects the economic environment, but also the security situation in some of our European markets. And this really presents an opportunity for us to win business away from our rivals in continental Europe. Moving on to slide 6, just want to give an overview for what we've been doing operationally. And the first thing to pick out in the top left-hand corner is how we have been doing with passenger satisfaction, which has continued to grow and has consistently been rated by passengers in the top quartile for well over a year now. And quarter three 2016 was the highest ever summer in terms of passenger rating that we have ever had. We measure this through the ASQ measure, which is a global benchmark, and we scored 4.14, which is up from 4.09 in 2015. And 81% of passengers are now rating Heathrow excellent or very good. And if you look at how we benchmark against some of the other major airports, we are still substantially ahead of the our European hub competitors and ahead of most of the other major airports in Europe. From a service point of view, we have had the highest punctuality that we have had. We've been working hard through our new airport operations center to make sure that we get planes in on time, turn them around efficiently, and that has been going very well. And that's one of the things that's contributed to the some of the best levels of baggage connections that we have ever seen at the airport. It's been that coupled with some really good work to improve the efficiency with which all of the companies operating baggage at the airport do their work. So making good progress there, and that, of course, all translates into passenger experience. Now, I will hand over to Javier to talk about the financial slides highlights on slide 8.
Thank you, John, and good afternoon to everyone and good morning to those members of the American Investor Community listening to us from the other side of the Atlantic. Moving on to financial performance on slide 8, we have seen a continued robust operating and financial performance with EBITDA up 4.4% in the period. 1.2% revenue growth reflects more passengers and increased retail and services revenue. On costs, as John mentioned, we continue to deliver year-on-year reduction, generating at the end of September a 3.4% annual decrease. Moving to the key features of our balance sheet, our regulatory asset base growth in the period is modest, similar trends that we already saw in the half-year results, reflecting two main trends. On the one hand, low inflation, reducing the year-on-year indexation uplift, albeit increasing in recent months. And on the other hand, a more modest investment program during the current regulatory period. In terms of net debt, we continue operating within guidance previously shared with investors. Our well-proven capital structure continue having plenty of headroom to covenants, with headroom to Heathrow Finance leverage covenants remaining around our 5 percentage points target. Turning to slide 9, let me share further details around our revenues. With a year-on-year reduction in aeronautical charges and constraints in runway capacity, revenue growth is primarily driven by continued strong retail growth. The majority of our revenue comes from aeronautical income, where performance is driven by two key factors. First, a fixed regulatory tariff, which decreases 1.5% in real prices during the current regulatory period. Second, passenger volumes. You can see in the chart, flat revenues reflecting an almost exact offset between those two factors. As previously said, the highlight of revenue performance continues being our retail income, which has accelerated to a year-on-year growth rate of 8.5% after 9 months, which compares with 7.7% at our half-year results. This outstanding performance that we are very proud of primarily reflects a large number of management initiatives that we have been building during the last couple of months, making Heathrow already a world-leading retail performance. Of course, this is absolutely key because operating under a single-till regulatory framework, it means that the larger the commercial value we can generate, the better for our core airlines and passengers. In terms of individual areas, airside specialist shops performance reflects the enhancement of Terminal 5's luxury retail proposition that was completed at the end of 2015. Car parking is also a significant contributor to this performance, with annual growth of 7.5%, which results from a broader product range and successful yield management. You might have also noticed that the significant pickup in year-on-year growth in tax and duty-free from 3.3% at the half year to 6.5% after 9 months of performance. This is one of the major areas where we have seen an immediate significant uplift in performance due to depreciation of sterling following the result of the EU referendum. In other income, as previously mentioned in the half-year results, it's worth to share some interesting dynamics within Heathrow Express. On the one hand, starting to use a more sophisticated pricing structure to drive passenger volumes. On the other hand, we have seen other regulated charges, which is a pass-through of cost that Heathrow incurs. The reduction in these revenues reflects actually a success in reducing costs, such as in baggage system operation, maintenance, and utilities, which ultimately enable our critical airline customers to deliver an end-to-end lower cost of operation. Moving on to slide 10 and to costs. We are very proud to show that improvement of service and operational performance do not need to come with an increase in cost. In fact, the chart illustrates that at the same time we're achieving record levels of passenger satisfaction and operational resilience, our cost per passenger are year-on-year down by more than 4%. We continue to deliver our cost reduction challenges as the year progresses, and we have already secured over 500 million pounds worth of the savings that we have committed to deliver during the whole of the current regulatory period. Getting into some of the details, employment cost efficiencies are flowing through with a reduction of 7.6%, driven by changes that we have been implemented, such as changes to the defined benefit pension scheme, implementation of voluntary severance schemes to accelerate attrition, and new entrant pay levels, plus some non-recurrence of some restructuring charges that we reported in 2015. The other notable feature on the cost side is the outcome of the successful renegotiation of a major contract for the provision of high-voltage electricity infrastructure services, first reported in our half-year results, that has resulted in a combination of not only one-off, but record savings in our reported numbers. This contract renegotiation joins other successes in improving terms of other major contracts that we have delivered in the last couple of years, such as the baggage systems operation and maintenance, NATS, and indeed, the defined benefit pension scheme. Slide 11 is a familiar slide for you, hopefully reflecting the cash flow generation over the period. As of the end of September, we generated over 1.2 billion of cash from operations. This has offset all of the capital investment, interest costs, and the majority of dividends and other restricted payments in the period. Taking into account all other cash outflows in the period, net debt increased just over 270 million pounds since year-end 2015 to just above 12 billion pounds. Although it's worth mentioning that 200 million pounds of those is related to simplifying our debt structure outside the SP group, which is the group that we are reporting results from today. I'll give you a bit more detail on shortly. Overall, We continue in a period with Heathrow moving to being cash generative after capital investment and interest, meaning that the net debt is expected to move in a relatively narrow band unless there's a pickup in inflation. Turning to our gearing position on slide 12, as of 30th of September, our gearing at Heathrow Finance is slightly lower than the level at the same point in 2015, and this is the result of our focus on capital management and the regulatory asset base picking up slightly with the recent inflation trends. We continue to enjoy very substantial headroom to the trigger and covenant leverage levels across our different tranches of debt, and in particular with over £750 million of headroom at Heathrow Finance level. We do, however, expect that the headroom at Heathrow Finance will decline slightly for a period as we are migrating around £200 million from a higher holding company into Heathrow Finance. Moving to slide 13 to share another period of successful developments on our debt financing, of course masterfully led by Andrew. Heathrow has continued to raise debt at attractive pricing from diverse sources, accounting to about £1.6 billion since the beginning of the year, including a £400 million 33-year public bond at the end of July, which marked a transaction that we opened the sterling primary market and at the time achieved the lowest ever coupon at any rating level for a 15-year plus maturity sterling bond. In terms of our financing strategy, our recent financing has been characterized by delayed drawdowns to try to reduce carry costs whilst providing certainty of term funding, which has allowed us to not only meet our financing costs, but at the same time extending materially our liquidity horizon. Our liquidity horizon now has moved until July 2019. In this slide, we have included the chart to provide some additional color on the impact of the financing strategy that we have been adopting. So you can see on the left-hand side of the chart that at the end of September, Heathrow had £2.2 billion of undrawn debt and cash resources. The cash flows shown below the line in the chart represent the bond maturities we have over the period to March 2017. And above the line, you can see the illustrative timings on when we may draw the nearly £800 million in delayed drawdowns debt that we have already secured. As you can see, the combination of £900 million in cash plus committed undrawn debt will comfortably cover all forthcoming maturities. In terms of next maturities after March 2017, our next financing debt maturity will be February 2018. And overall, as already mentioned, our liquidity horizon extends now to July 2019. Overall, we remain very encouraged by the continued strong global support for all the credit investor community. And as John already mentioned, I joined him to take the opportunity to give you my gratitude for that. But also this position has been reinforced by Fitch, which has moved Heathrow from a stable to a positive rating outlook status just earlier this month. So wrapping up on slide 14, before handing back to John and to talk about more strategic developments, my summary of the results is that we believe that we have a strong performance this year. We have very encouraging service and operational performance with unprecedented external recognition of the high-quality service we are providing to passengers and airlines. We have seen higher passenger numbers, good cost control, and new retail initiatives that collectively have driven a close to 4.4% increase in EBITDA for the year to date. From a financing perspective, we are in excellent shape, and as I just mentioned, our liquidity horizon now extends to July 2019. We have completed our plans for 2016, and we are now in the process of preparing our funding approach for 2017. And while there is reason to be cautious given the outcome of the EU referendum, we are operating in the knowledge that Heathrow has proven resilient in earlier periods of macroeconomic instability. And through the coming months, we expect to have a renewed focus on securing further efficiencies, but overall, we expect that 2016 full-year EBITDA to be broadly consistent with the outlook published in our investor report in June. Thank you very much for your attention, and I'll hand back now to John.
Great. Thank you, Javier. So let me just finish off by giving you a strategic update on slide 16. You'll remember that our vision is to give passengers the best airport service in the world, and our model for doing that is to engage with our people. That's what we call Mojo, making Heathrow a great place to work. And if we do that well, then it's our people who deliver transformed customer service. And if we can both reduce costs and encourage more passengers to come and use Heathrow, then that allows us to beat our financial plan. So that's our plan A. Our plan B is to win support for expansion and get the opportunity to grow our airport as well as to deliver on all the strategic plans above. So let me just give you a quick update on what we've been doing. So from a Mojo point of view, we've been doing a huge amount of work to develop the talent that we have within our business, bringing through graduates and interns, engineering apprenticeships, making sure that they have good training. And that investment in our people, I think, has helped to contribute to the ballot not to take industrial action by Unite members, who make up just over 3,000 of our 6,500 people at Heathrow. They voted in the summer not to take industrial action. And I think this new relationship we have with our people is a really excellent contributor towards that. Coming up, there's a lot of work that we're doing around diversity, making sure that we make the most of the very diverse population we have in our the junior levels of the organization and help them to develop up through the business. We've made some good progress there. And we have our graduation for the Heathrow Academy, which is where we take typically unemployed people from the local community and find jobs for them at the airport. We have about 500 people a year who successfully go through the academy and come into work here. So that's something we're very proud of, and which is one of the ways in which we give back to our local communities. Secondly, in terms of transforming customer service, there's been quite a lot happening here. One big thing you may have noticed is that we have fully co-located Delta and Virgin into Terminal 3. Since they formed their alliance a few years ago, they've been operating split between Terminal 3 and Terminal 4, and it's clearly better for them to be in one place, and most of all for their passengers. And we're very pleased that that has worked successfully, and that's a result of really good collaboration between those two airlines and ourselves and others across the airport to make sure that they use the space they have really efficiently. And that's a good model for how we want to work with all of our airlines. We've started the what's known as the H7 regulatory process. That's the next five-year period. And we started that with an airline conference where we got together all of our airlines, regulator, actually members of the local community and cargo operators to try to understand what people were going to be needing over the coming planning period. And that was a really effective way of listening to our customers and stakeholders. And one other thing that we've done recently is to make sure that Heathrow is present on Weibo and WeChat, which are the two main social media channels in China. And that's a very important channel for getting to one of the highest growth markets that we've been enjoying. And you can see just how important that is with the growth that we've seen to China. What we've got coming up, we are going to be launching our new sustainability strategy over the next 3 or 4 months. And that is part of our ambition to make Heathrow a real leader in sustainability in our local community, nationally, and in some of the big global issues. And earlier this week, we were involved in a launch of the anti-slavery campaign, which the government has been leading. And as a big international hub, you can imagine that this is potentially a channel for people trafficking, and we want to play our part to be responsible. We've also got a partnership with Hong Kong Airport. We currently have some of our managers working in Hong Kong, some Hong Kong managers working over here. That's a really productive exchange, both for developing our managers, but sharing best practice. And Hong Kong is a sort of twin sister for Heathrow, and I look forward to deepening that relationship. They are similar size. They have two runways. They're just slightly ahead of us with their third runway plan, so we have a lot that we can learn from each other. And internally, we're bringing together all of our customer databases to make it easier for us to communicate in a much more joined-up way with our passengers. In terms of the beta plan, lots of things going on here. We have completed our LED stand lighting program. That's allowed us to reduce the number of lights we have and significantly reduce the operating cost for stand lighting. You'll understand how important that is. The new lights use 64% less energy than their predecessors, and we need about two-thirds of them to do the job. So that's been really excellent, and we're doing a lot of work internally to make sure we are as efficient as we can be. And some of this is 3 or 4 months ago, when we could see the economic market was uncertain, we thought it was prudent to start tightening our belt just in case the economy slowed down, and I think that's a very sensible thing to have done, and will stand us in good stead. We've also opened the Terminal 5 Personal Shopper Lounge, which we have a similar scheme in Terminal 2 that's been hugely successful, so we've just extended that to Terminal 5. Things we've got coming up, well, we've got the possibility of extending Q6 by another year. We're just finalising that with the CAA and with airlines. That gives us another year of stability. We've been working with Skyscanner on something called Go Heathrow, which is a social media travel booking site. So you can go through Facebook and book flights from Heathrow to anywhere in the world. And that's a good way of starting to build passenger volumes. Of course, we've got a lot of Christmas activity coming up, planning ahead for that busy family time of year. And you'll be delighted to know that we have a new Harry Potter store opening in Terminal 5. So you can get all of your witchcraft and wizardry tools without having to go to Diagon Alley. In terms of expansion, we've come a long way, and I think we have the end in sight. We've done a lot of work to make sure that our plan is affordable, reflecting the desire from our airlines. They've been very consistent that Heathrow is the right place to expand, but not at any cost. And we have developed what we call our quicker and cheaper plan, which allows us to expand with no increase in passenger charges on average. And that's something we will now, if we are recommended for expansion, we'll work on that closely with airlines to make sure that we deliver the airport that that our passengers need sustainably and sensitively for the local community. And I'm really pleased with the support that we've seen from politicians across the country. The Scottish Government recently endorsed us. The DUP, which is the fourth largest party in Whitehall, in Westminster, they've endorsed us too. Very strong backing from the Parliamentary Labour Party, and very strong support within the Conservative Party. So I think if we are selected, we have a very strong political base, and very strong support from local residents, 30,000 of whom have written in to the Prime Minister expressing their support. So we're in a much better position to deliver both for local people and nationally. And what we call our Brexit boost, we have found that with the improvements we've made in the resilience of the airport, we are now much more confident that we could, if we had permission to have more flights on our existing two runways, we could do so. And that will allow us to get more flights from UK regions going on to more emerging markets sooner than the new runway comes in, so potentially 2021. And that will give us a head start and will clearly be good for the UK economy, good for airlines, and will help to smooth out prices, which again is important for passengers. So that's a good step forward. Now, where are we with expansion decisions? Well, you'll have seen some mixed messages coming out in the media, but let me just take you through what we do know. In terms of the decision-making process, the Prime Minister has said that she will make a decision next week. We don't know which date yet, but there's a lot of speculation that that will probably be on Tuesday, but that's not certain. She's also said that there'll be a recommendation for one site. So you may have seen there was speculation that she might recommend both Heathrow and Gatwick, or Heathrow and Gatwick and Birmingham. But our understanding is it'll just be a single location. And we're looking forward to that. I think we're very well placed. What will happen after that is that if we are selected, we'll then start on a two-stage planning process, the first of which is called the National Policy Statement, which is, if you like, the outline planning consent, which confirms what it is we're going to deliver and that will be subject to a full consultation and will culminate in a vote in Parliament either towards the end of 2017 or beginning of 2018. And that was confirmed in a letter written by that came out of Number 10, the Prime Minister's office. The next stage of that is a development consent order, which is the detailed planning consent, which again will be subject to a huge amount of consultation to make sure we're taking on board all of the concerns of local people. And that will conclude sometime towards the end of 2020 with a planning consent from the Secretary of State for Transport, after which we will be able to get on and build the new runway. And our current forecasts are that if we get the consent at the end of 2020, we will get the new runway complete and open for passengers in early 2025. But as I've mentioned, we should be able to get more flights off the existing runways before then. So that's the timetable. We are what the government announced a couple of days ago is exactly in line with that timetable. So my sense with the government is there's a real sense of momentum, and they're an administration that wants to get things done. And I think that once they've made their mind up, they will want to push ahead as soon as they can. And you may also have seen a lot of speculation about legal challenges, judicial reviews. Well, the judicial reviews only can be brought once a decision has been made, which is with the national policy statement, because there has to be something which one is legally challenging. And they happen in parallel with any planning consent. So any big infrastructure project is going to get some challenges like that. So we shouldn't be surprised if people are looking to do that at Heathrow. But as of today, there is no basis on which there's no decision which could be judicially reviewed. In terms of that planning process, the National Policy Statement and the Development Consent Order, this is the norm for any major infrastructure project, actually for small ones too. So projects you might be familiar with, Hinkley or the Thames Tideway Tunnel, they have all gone through this process, and the success rate is very high. I think there's only been 2 out of nearly 60 projects which have gone through this process which haven't led to a successful planning application, one of which was withdrawn early. So I think this is a good way of going forward. I think we're well placed to get a positive decision next week, but we can't take anything for granted, but we'll want to move on as quickly as we can to deliver the extra runway capacity this country needs. So that is where we are. I'm sure that there will be a lot more speculation in the newspapers over the weekend and a lot more news next week when a decision is finally announced. So that is all that we wanted to cover. We'd now like to open up the call to any questions you might have, and Andrew, Javier and I would be happy to take them.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press 01 on your telephone keypads. You can press 02 at any time to withdraw your question. There will now be a brief pause while questions are being registered. And our first question comes from the line of Danielle Ward of JP Morgan. Please go ahead. Your line is now open.
Hello. Thanks very much for the update. I just had a couple of follow-up questions on financing, if possible. So I don't know if you're able to disclose the interest rates on the term loans you've issued recently, but if not, I wondered how they compare economically to bond rates and what your preference is for the balance of loans versus bonds in the cap structure. And then secondly, you commented on moving to a simpler cap structure and paying down some of the debt at a higher up level. I just wondered what is driving this, and are you looking to repay the remaining debt at the ADI level in the future? Thank you.
Well, Danielle, those are great questions, and the answers to them are on the tip of my tongue, but I feel it was only fair to ask Andrew to answer them.
Afternoon, Danielle. I mean, we've entered into term loans at both the Class A with a set of banks, five banks, and at the Heathrow Finance level as well, which is a combination of actually banks and institutional lenders. And that the Class A term loan was put in place shortly before the Brexit referendum. So, if you like, it was sort of our liquidity insurance policy to some degree. And that, at the time, showed a relative value benefit versus versus bonds. It's only a 3.75 year loan and was priced at LIBOR plus 85 basis points. So those were the economic terms for that transaction. On the at the Heathrow Finance level, I think it's fair to say over the last couple of years that that loans have generally offered much better value than bonds for borrowers. That's now more or less evened up. But the transactions we've entered into were pretty attractive, but they had sort of slightly different terms and different tranches in terms of maturity. So, but suffice to say that spreads, I think, generally have been in sort of average spreads have generally been around 3 to 3.5 or 3.75%, depending on maturity, Danielle. In terms of balance of loans and bonds, I think at Class A level, we generally expect in the medium term to have by far predominantly bonds. So this is relatively unusual, having a Class A term loan. But at the Heathrow Finance level, we expect to actively look to keep a good mix between loans and bonds, where there's quite a lot of institutional lenders keen to lend at that level of the cap structure. And I think finally you had a little bit of a question around ADIF2. I think it's sort of long been our plan to try to simplify, make more transparent even our overall debt capital structure by reducing the number of layers from 4 to 3. And we've kind of completed phase one of that, and we will need to figure out over the coming months or year what we do about the other 300 million or so that's at that level still. Okay.
Very helpful, thank you.
Great, thank you, Andrew.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of James Sparrow of BNP Paribas. Please go ahead, your line is now open.
Yes. Hi. Good afternoon, everyone. A couple of questions. Just one, just regarding the planning process. You know, should the third runway get approved? Just curious to see whether the sort of 12-month process for the national policy statement to be devised, whether that realistically represents a bit of a delay, or did whether you actually envisaged that process taking a kind of a rough amount of time similar to that. And then secondly, just wanted to delve briefly into the world of pension accounting, so apologies for that, but just a little bit curious, looking at the IAS 19 going into a deficit, and then obviously you had the actuarial review and the actual funding appears to have gone down. So I know this is a little bit apples and pears, but I was just wondering if you could help explain that a bit. Thanks.
Great. Well, let me handle the first of those while Javier will cover the second. It's, funnily enough, we, as you can imagine, we have lots of press releases and different versions of announcements lined up just in case we get a decision. We have a slide in the pack that we circulated now, which has which we prepared a couple of weeks ago, which has exactly the timetable that the Prime Minister announced a couple of days ago. So we had always expected that there would be a national policy statement with a legal vote. That's the best way of delivering a programme like this. So although some newspapers were talking about that being a delay, it really isn't. That's exactly what we had expected. I think the only reason people were using that language was because there was an expectation that there would be a vote in Parliament, a non-binding vote, shortly after an announcement was made, just to show where the will of Parliament stood. And it sounds as if that's less likely to happen. Now, there is no need for that vote. It has no legal basis. I think we'd all, if we're selected, it would be nice to see the will of MPs, and I'm pretty confident we would get a very significant support if that were to happen. But it's not necessary, nor is it particularly expected. The important thing is that we start the national policy statement process, and I think the Prime Minister has laid out a clear process and timetable for that, which is great, and it's quite a big step forward from where her predecessor had been. So, Javi, do you want to cover the pensions point?
Yeah. Hello, James. Well, as you well know, Heathrow operates both a defined contribution and a defined benefit pension scheme. In terms of the defined benefit pension scheme, it was closed to new members in June 2008. And I think that here we have to differentiate two things, as you rightly mentioned. First of all, is from a cash perspective, we completed a new actuarial valuation just before December, with better terms. We significantly reduced the accrual and the service cost from around 33% to 23%, which is generating around £12 million of annual savings, which is contributing to our £600 million challenge, as well as reducing our actuarial deficit by around £230 million, which you can see in the exceptional lines that we booked last year when we closed the new revised terms. From a finance, from an accounting perspective, though, we have to mark to market the value of the assets and the value of the liabilities. And what we have seen during 2016 and then accelerated with the outcome of the EU referendum is a fall in gilt yields, which means that liabilities have grown faster than assets, which has created a non-cash pension deficit movement of around £474 million. So this is something that we have to mark to market our liabilities, but that's a non-cash impact. From a cash perspective, we have the new terms that will last at least 3 years more.
That's very clear. Thank you.
Thanks,
Javier.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Neil Bedall of Fidelity. Please go ahead. Your line is now open.
Thank you. Just a simple one, really, hopefully. I notice you reported a sort of a net loss before tax and also a net loss overall, which seems to be due to both interest rate swap and index link swaps, which account for about a negative £523 million or so. I know we saw some of this at the interim stage as well, but I just wondered if you could explain this a bit more to us. I mean, are these swaps not eligible for hedge accounting? Are they likely to continue to be a feature, or are they going to unwind in a relatively short term? Sort of any clarity you could give on that would be quite useful. Thank you.
Great. Well, I'll ask Kavi to cover that. I mean, those... As more of an operational person, those non-cash adjustments drive me nuts because whenever we do the results, there's a massive swing in the numbers on a non-cash basis, and it's the thing that journalists always ask about. That wow, you're suddenly 7,000% up on last year or 5,000,000% down. But I'm glad you understand what's really going on behind it. So.
Thank you, Neil. I think it's a feature of that we are living in a more scary world where accountants need to know more around net present value than the old debit and credit. But I think in terms of our accounting, effectively the movements in the period is driven by two things, as you rightly mentioned. First of all, is interest rate swaps, which is contributing to £200 million adverse movement of the total circa 500 that we have seen in the period. The interest rate swaps, of course, we hedge our exposure to interest rates, and this is something that is part of our commitments with the investor community as part of our funding arrangement. So we have to be hedged at least 75% of interest rate exposure, and some of them don't enjoy hedge accounting and hence impacts, introduces some volatility in the P&L. In terms of the index-linked swaps, which contributes to the other £300 million, we don't have a hedge accounting, but the natural rationale behind implementing those index-linked swaps is because of it's a natural hedge to the inflation linkage that we have in our regulatory asset base. From an accounting perspective, we don't enjoy hedge accounting, but from an economic perspective, it provides a natural hedge. So what we have seen is an increase in the shortened RPI curve during the first 9 months of the period, which is increasing our liabilities as well as our regulatory asset base. But the former doesn't impact positively our accounting.
Right, okay. So can I take it from that, because it sounds as if there's a reasonable amount that's not hedge accounted, we could expect to see continued volatility of that depending on interest rate or RPI movements going forward. Would that be a correct assumption?
That's a correct assumption, and actually during the last couple of years we have seen some volatility moving in the other direction as well. But that's your assumption, yeah.
Okay. All right, that's great. Thank you very much for that, Tom.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Michael Poznanski of M&G Investments. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Good afternoon. Just a quick question for me. I noticed that the dividend payment sort of went up quite markedly in the quarter on a year-over-year basis. And I was just wondering sort of what we should read into that and what we should expect from dividends, sort of should you get the permission for the third runway. Are these likely to remain at elevated levels during the planning process, or will there be a sort of a degree of sort of pre-funding, as you will, from the shareholders during this process ahead of the more sort of heavier construction phase? Thank you.
Great. No, that's a good question. There are two elements to this. There's the underlying level of dividends, and then there is some internal accounting movements between group companies. And I'll let Javier just unpack those. But what we've said with expansion, if we're given the go-ahead, is that we will maintain our current credit rating. That means that we will make sure that shareholders are investing in the airport. Whether that is through reducing dividends or an equity injection is not yet been decided. But that's the principle that we've established. And I think we've probably shared that before. In terms of that specific movement, Javier, do you want to just explain how that breaks down?
Yeah, hi, Michael. In terms of dividends, I think it's a bit confusing, and that's driven by accounting terminology. So in our cash flow, in our summary cash flow statement on page 10, you can see a dividend paid of £486 million. Actually, 486 is a combination of both dividends to ultimate shareholders and intra-group dividends. As a result of the scope of reports of this press release. So if we go by parts, first of all, in terms of the amount of dividends to external ultimate shareholders, the dividends paid during the period is £225 million. You can see the details on page 11, and that's exactly the same amount as in previous years. So in terms of our dividend policy, of course, it's a great feature of the healthiness of our business that we are able to prepare to pay a steady dividend growth, but that's coupled with other restricted payments, which is primarily driven by some cash inflows and outflows outside the Heathrow SP group. Some of that related with the first stages of amalgamating our ADI Finance to debt into Heathrow Finance. Is that clear, Michael?
Okay, so the so over and above the 225, obviously there's the sort of payments on the normal then, but there's a degree of I guess extra payments further up the structure that shouldn't reoccur. Is that the right way of thinking about it?
Correct. Yeah.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Miguel Marina of JB Capital. Please go ahead. Your line is now open.
Yeah, good afternoon. Two questions. The first one is on these additional 25,000 movements. If I understood correctly, this is conditional on being granted the authorization for the third runway. And I was wondering why this is the case, because I think this represents an increase of capacity of around 4 or 5%. So that should be something, you know, worthwhile doing on its own merit, whether you have the third runway or not. And then the second question was, you mentioned during the presentation that you were confident that the administration would go for a single location for the additional capacity in the southeast. And my question is whether legally the administration can opt for both Gatwick and Heathrow, if legally that is a possibility, and if this is the case and that happens, what would be Heathrow's reaction to that? Thank you.
Great, thank you. So if I just say the first one, just to give you a bit of background, we have a planning cap of 480,000 movements a year, which was set as a condition of the planning application for Terminal 5. And so we've been careful to stay within that. So any increase in air traffic movements above 480,000 would need a planning application. And so so it's not something that the Secretary of State can unilaterally agree to. Our assumption is that as we go through the planning application for expansion and we're going through a full consultation that would be required with a planning application, this is one of the things that we would want to consult on, and there will need to be some mitigation for local communities as we do that, because it increases the number of flights. That's why we have said our planning assumption is that that wouldn't happen before 2021, and it's related to expansion. Just in terms of that volume of movement, there are some things that we would want to do to maintain resilience at that level. So some changes in the way we operate, some change in airspace. But overall, if you look at our very busiest month in the summer, we already operate at an equivalent level of movement. It's just we don't do it all the year round. So we certainly have the resilience now to be able to do it. But we need to get the permission to do that as an increase. Now, in terms of single location, as you will probably tell from the newspapers, there is very little being said by government. We actually don't know anything more than you do about what the government's plans are, whether any decisions have yet been made. But you'll see speculation about all kinds of combinations. The reason I mentioned that I understood there'd only be a single location is that that was in one of the statements that came out of Downing Street. That makes sense, because that is the any government decision needs to be based on needs to have some policy basis. And the policy basis here is the Airports Commission, which said only one new runway before 2030 and a second by 2040. It would be surprising if the government were to move significantly away from that. Our view has always been that we respect the right of any airport to expand, not just Gatwick, but other airports too, but not at the expense of Heathrow, because of the unique contribution we make to the British economy, connecting UK regions to all the emerging markets of the world. That's something that you can only do from a hub airport. So we don't want to see Heathrow held back in being able to do that. And that's been a consistent position that we would take. But I think that there have been other airports that have been concerned about the government possibly approving both Heathrow and Gatwick. I know that Stansted Airport, which is owned by Manchester Airports Group, would be keen to be considered for the next new runway. If we're chosen now, that they want to be able to compete with Gatwick. So I'm sure that they wouldn't be happy if government were to approve both now, and if that reduced their chances of expansion further down the line.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Just to remind participants, if you would like to ask a question, please press 01 on your telephone keypads now. And we have no further questions, so I'll return the call to John Holland Kay for closing comments.
Great, well, thank you. And thank you for some really good questions. I take it from the tone of some of them that you are updating your financial models and forecasts. I hope that is a sign of confidence that we will get approval next week, and I certainly hope we will, and I know that we've had very strong support from the financial community for that. So thank you, and I'm sure we will be updating you shortly after getting a decision. It is important for the UK, it's very important for London, and very important for the City of London to maintain one of the world's great financial centres. And of course, once we start getting ready for the financing, we will need your support. And we've been actively planning for this for a number of years with the excellent work that Andrew has been doing to widen the investment base. With the funding structure that we have, that puts us in a very good position. And we will want to work with you to make sure that we can deliver one of the world's great hub airports that will keep Britain as a great trading nation. Hopefully we'll get some good news next week. If not, you'll be delighted to know I'll have to shut up about this for a while. We'll be focusing more on our core business. But thank you for your time today, and if there are any other things that anyone would like to pick up, then please feel free to get in touch with Andrew. Thank you.
This now concludes our call. Thank you for attending. Participants, you may disconnect your lines.